Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, an analyst speaks with us about the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
The two are on opposite sides of the major conflicts in the region.
We'll have details of a new report called Jihad Against Journalists. A drive to reform U.S. gun control regulations has set off a firestorm. And the unpredictable Justin Bieber is predictable by having another big musical hit. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. Tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran continue to mount, with Kuwait, Bahrain, and Sudan taking diplomatic action against Iran. This comes in the wake of damage to the Saudi embassy in Tehran by protesters angry over the Saudi execution of a popular Shiite cleric and activist, Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel al-Jubayr also said his government was cutting trade and air links with Iran for what he called its aggressive policies.
The Iranians and their allies have been pushing and promoting terrorism and recruiting people, inciting, providing weapons and explosives to people, and Nimr was one of them. He's a man who was agitating, who was organizing cells, who was providing to them with weapons and money. He was engaged in attacks against Saudi security forces that led to the death of people. In short, he was a terrorist.
The Saudi diplomat, when asked what it would take to restore relations with Iran, says it must cease and desist from interfering in the internal affairs of other countries. The dispute has the potential to disrupt efforts to forge peace in both Syria and Yemen. And that's why White House spokesman Josh Earnest called on both sides to de-escalate the situation.
We're urging all sides to show some restraint and to not further inflame tensions that are on quite vivid display in the region. And we believe that there is more that can be done by people on all sides to try to bridge those divides in a way that advances the interests of countries all across the region. For example, the Syria, I think, situation is probably the most vivid example of this. It is so clearly in the interests of both countries to advance a political solution to the situation inside of Syria.
Earnest said one reason he remains hopeful the Syrian peace effort will move forward is that it remains in the interests of both Iran and Saudi Arabia to achieve a political solution. Northwestern University Middle East Studies professor Nabil Khoury tells VOA's Victor Beatty the rivalry between the two countries has been going on since Iran became an Islamic republic.
This rivalry intensified after the Khomeini revolution in 1979, and it's been up and down ever since. The two are on opposite sides of the major conflicts in the region. They're on opposite sides of the war in Yemen. They're on opposite sides in Iraq, in Syria, definitely. And in Lebanon, even though there is no active war in Lebanon, the main factions in the country, one is supported by Saudi Arabia and the other is supported by Iran. So they seem to take opposite sides of any conflict in the region, except on IS, the Organization of the Islamic State. They're in principle both fighting this form of extremism in the region, but neither one of them is being all that serious in prioritizing ISIS.
There's a lot of concern expressed at the UN and here in Washington about the impact these tensions will have on peace efforts in Yemen and Syria.
Yes, obviously, I think the hope was with John Kerry's intensive efforts to bring about some kind of a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Syria, or at least get things started on the right footing. And it was obviously difficult even before this latest development. But now with this latest development, it's pretty impossible at this point to get Saudi Arabia and Iran on the same side of that question. I mean, they're breaking off diplomatic ties, so they're not even going to be willing to talk to one another. That definitely sets back peace efforts in Syria, which were minimal to begin with. But it also makes things difficult in Iraq. It makes things very difficult in Yemen, where Iran does not have that much influence, but Saudi Arabia, convinced that the Houthis are being backed by Iran, has refused to compromise with the Houthis in Yemen.
Nabil Khoury with Northwestern University. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged Saudi Arabia to renew its ceasefire with the Houthi rebels that it is bombing since March. And Special UN Envoy Stefan de Mistura is visiting both Saudi Arabia and Iran to gain what a UN spokesman called an assessment of the impact of tensions on the Vienna process for Syria. The envoy has set January 25th as a target date for a fourth round of talks on Syria's political future. Well, now it's time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is my colleague, Sarah Williams. Hi there, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. We're looking at reaction on social media. Bloomberg Business reports that at other times, a disagreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia would mean a hike in oil prices. But this time, the reaction has been muted. That's according to industry analysts. Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates have sided with Saudi Arabia after Riyadh executed a Shiite cleric critical of the Saudi kingdom. Foreign Policy reports that crude oil prices fell on Monday despite the increasing tensions between OPEC's two biggest powers. It says the global oil glut is responsible. Meanwhile, Kuwait recalled its ambassador to Tehran. Agence France-Presse reports that Kuwait made the announcement following the weekend a weekend attack on the Saudi embassy in Tehran. The UN Security Council condemned the attack, and that followed Saudi Arabia's decision to execute the prominent Shiite cleric. In other news, hashtag Hellman is just starting to trend. That's because a U.S. service member was killed and two others wounded during fighting in the Afghan province on Tuesday. Defense officials told U.S. media outlets that U.S. special forces were involved in the operation near the city of Marja. Well, also trending is hashtag Too Cold Tuesday. Those of us here on the east coast of the United States are dealing with chilly temperatures. Since our weather was relatively warm only recently, we don't have too much to complain about. But Bloomberg reports that the temperature is the coldest in New York since last winter. Biting cold in the eastern U.S. powered demand for electricity to heat houses and businesses. The temperature in New York Central Park was 17 degrees Fahrenheit. That's minus 8 Celsius at 10 a.m. The day's norm is 38, according to AccuWeather. Coffea tweets, was 10 below freezing when I got up. It's now 10 above. Staying in bed till noon seems to be a suitable workaround. Kristen Mandari tweets, this Too Cold Tuesday brought to you by the only place I want to be right now, Aruba. Well, Aruba sounds especially nice just about now. Susan?
I'll go there anytime, Sarah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Sarah. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
From time to time, the Internet buzzes with rumors of an approaching asteroid that just might pose a danger to us. Now, a team of British astronomers say giant comets, called centaurs, in the far reaches of our solar system may pose more of a threat to life on Earth than asteroids. The scientists say that these centaurs move through the solar system in unstable orbits past our outer planets of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The gravitational fields from these planets can deflect these objects into a trajectory that puts Earth in its path. The scientists calculated that one of these giant comets gets deflected into an Earthbound path every 40 to 100,000 years. While most are expected to break down into dust and larger fragments, the amount of debris created could make an Earth impact almost certain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Almost a year after deadly attacks on the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo in Paris, a new report by Reporters Without Borders calls jihadism among the world's worst predators of press freedom. The organization has released a new report titled Jihad Against Journalists. It summarizes efforts by Islamist armed groups such as Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab to intimidate and silence journalists and to repress the societies they cover. Joining us on the line is spokesperson Margot Ewan. Welcome, Margot.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. What did your organization find?
So we tried to trace back some of the origins of the increased violence that has been targeting journalists over the past couple of years. And we did note that there was a blacklist of 11 journalists, cartoonists, and intellectuals from Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine published in the spring of 2013 that actually included Stéphane Charbonnier, the cartoonist also known as Charb, who was Charlie Hebdo's publisher and one of the victims of last year's massacre on the 7th of January.
Do you have any details about what these organizations are doing specifically?
We do analyze specifically a lot of information with regard to Daesh, the Islamic State, because their propaganda is very sophisticated. They basically have two separate media strategies. One is to promote the organization and the benefits of joining it. The other is to use terrorizing tactics in video and online social media, showing staged executions, tortures, and military operations on behalf of their organization. In addition to taking local journalists hostage in the areas that they have taken over, they also gain immediate media attention when they detain or take hostage foreign journalists. And that can also serve as an important financial incentive for them as well to raise money based on ransoms.
You note 11 commandments for journalists from these organizations.
Yes. So the 11 commandments come from the Islamic State back in October of last year in the Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor. And it's kind of like an embryonic media law issued by Daesh. And some of those commandments forbid journalists from working for TV channels that are against Islamic State because, as we know, journalists are seen by the Islamic State as enemy combatants and they are to be targeted, which is a very radical escalation of violence against journalists that we hadn't seen on such an intense level before IS came into play. Another element from these 11 commandments is that journalists are not allowed to publish any article without first consulting the media office of Daesh. And the regulations are, of course, mentioned that they'll be subject to change under circumstances. So they are just guidelines. And ultimately, the journalists who disobey ISIS will be left up to the fate of whoever is in charge of punishing them at that time.
Well, thank you very much, Margot, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up on International Edition, folks in Washington are hopping over gun control regulations, and there's another hit from a big pop name. U.S. President Barack Obama is working to change gun control regulations in the United States. Some of the measures first announced by the White House on Monday include expanded background checks, more effective enforcement of gun laws, increased mental health treatment, and reporting to the National Background Check System. This issue is extremely controversial among lawmakers on Capitol Hill here in Washington. And joining us here in the studio is Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Susan.
Well, this is the hot topic of the day, week, month here in the U.S. Let's start with the Republicans. What are they saying?
Well, Republicans strongly object to this on three grounds. Number one, constitutional grounds. They say that this infringes on the Second Amendment, which does guarantee the right of U.S. citizens to bear arms. They object to it on policy grounds, saying that it makes no sense to make law-abiding people jump through hoops to get arms, that doing so will do nothing to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and violent people. And number three, they object to it on what you might call procedural grounds. Congress has not passed any laws on gun control or any laws on firearms, period, for quite some time. And Republicans argue that inaction by Congress does not mean that the president is automatically granted license to act on his own.
Yes, I should explain that in this country, Congress is responsible for writing laws, actually, although the president does have some executive powers. So there's a little gray area in there.
There is indeed a gray area, and Congress does pass laws, but it is up to the executive branch to enforce them and in some cases to interpret them. And there is some leeway.
Okay. And is there some opposition among the president's own people, the Democrats?
There is opposition, particularly among Democrats like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a very conservative state, Senator Joe Manchin. He is very firmly in favor of the rights of gun owners. But most Democrats are going to rally behind the president on this. They point out that the Second Amendment is not an absolute guarantee to own any kind of arm under any circumstance. I mean, you and I aren't going to go out. You and I can't go out and buy a bazooka if we wanted to. There are certain common sense restrictions. And so there are going to be Democrats who will strongly rally behind the president.
This is all peaking because of the recent violence we've seen in this country and elsewhere in the world and the threat of terrorism. But I've heard that this move by the president to take action on gun control, this may be challenged all the way to the Supreme Court.
Indeed. Susan, there was going to be a lot of sound and fury coming from Capitol Hill over President Obama's announcement, but it really will signify very little because this, like so many other areas, is likely to be determined not by Congress, but in the judiciary, by the federal courts. These are battles that are likely to continue through the remainder of President Obama's administration. And in fact, it could be decided whether these policies continue simply by whether or not a Democrat or a Republican is elected to succeed him.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael, for stopping by. This will be an interesting story to follow.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Green Beef, for a healthier planet.
From almost the beginning of its colonization, Virginia was a tobacco state, and despite falling cigarette sales, it remains the state's largest crop. According to Julian Bobe of Titan Bioenergy Systems, there are other uses for tobacco, though, namely ethanol.
In the United States, we produce about 15 billion gallons of ethanol, and most of it comes from corn.
So Titan Bioenergy plans to begin producing ethanol from tobacco.
Corn, you can get a little bit over 300 gallons per acre. If we use tobacco, we can get about 1,000 gallons per acre.
Bobby points out that tobacco isn't a food crop, and the entire plant can be utilized.
As compared to traditional tobacco, where only the leaves are being used.
Bobby predicts tobacco will eventually be competitive with corn.
Our intention is to put sugar from tobacco directly into the fermentation tank of any ethanol factory in the United States.
Titan will soon begin production of tobacco ethanol in North Carolina. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Larry London of Border Crossings has joined me here in the studio, and he is here to talk about a fellow in the music world that has been in the headlines so many times. It's just incredible. And usually it's because this guy has been naughty. But Larry's got some exciting news about Justin Bieber and his song.
That's right, a new song.
Love Yourself.
Love Yourself. It's from his new album, which, by the way, happens to be Justin's fifth album to sell over 1 million copies. So, yes, Susan, you're right. He's had a lot of problems in the last couple of years. And he says himself, you know, he learned from his mistakes. He's turned the corner. He's 21 now. Let's face it, when he first got fame, he was just a teenager and wasn't ready to be making $40 million, $50 million a year and having all the attention he was getting at the time. So, you know, he says he's grown up. He's learned from his mistakes. The year is still young. But we hope that all of this is true. He's going out on tour for his new album in the United States. It's a world tour, but it starts in the U.S. in March, promoting his new album Purpose, which he said finally has given his music purpose.
Well, let me ask you about this. Has he lost some of his fan base as a result of not being as bizarre as he was before? Or
absolutely,
his good looks and his good voice and his good dancing are carrying him on.
Exactly. Not only has he managed to sustain the fan base he developed as a teen, he's now attracting their moms and the older generation who are attracted by the very things you just mentioned, his abs and his good looks and all. You know, he's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed young boy, grew up in Canada on a very, very meager income. His mom was the one who raised him in Canada as a single parent, didn't have any money coming in. They were on food stamps for a while. He got discovered on YouTube with his videos and music, and he's just lit it up ever since, and he's going out on tour. The new song, by the way, which is the third from his Purpose album, is already the first number one song in the UK.
Wow.
not the first ever, obviously, but the first one for 2016.
Well, tell me about Love Yourself.
Love Yourself. Now, that's an interesting song. He says the whole album was inspired by his relationship with Selena Gomez. He's admitted that. The two of them are no longer together. In fact, he's been on vacation with his new girlfriend, 19-year-old Haley Baldwin, the daughter of actor Stephen Baldwin. And so he made it known to the world that the two of them are in a relationship because he just put on Instagram a photo of the two of them kissing. But the album, he says, was inspired by the love he still holds for Selena Gomez. And it's a beautiful ballad.
Okay, well, let's hear it right now. Thank you very much, Larry London of Border Crossings, for stopping by.
Oh, thank you, Susan, for having me.
And if you think that I'm still holding on to something, you should go and love yourself. When you told me that you hated my friends, the only problem was with you and not them. And every time you told me my opinion was wrong, and tried to make me forget where I came from. And I didn't want to write a song, 'cause I didn't want anyone thinking I still care or don't. But you still hit my phone up, and baby, I'll be moving on. And I think it should be something I don't want to hold back. Maybe you should know that my mama don't like you, and she likes everyone. And I never liked to admit that I was wrong. And I've been so caught up in my job, didn't see what's going on. But now I know I'm better sleeping on my own. 'Cause if you like the way you look that much, oh baby, you should go and love yourself.
I like that song. I like it. Anyway, we'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The board of directors of the Millennium Challenge Corporation recently held its quarterly meeting and approved three countries as eligible for compacts and two countries as eligible for threshold programs. MCC is an independent U.S. government agency working to reduce global poverty through economic growth. Three of the five countries are new partners for MCC, and all have worked hard to improve their performance on MCC's scorecard, which measures countries' commitment to ruling justly, economic freedom, and investing in their people. The board selected Côte d'Ivoire, Kosovo, and Senegal as newly eligible for compacts. Côte d'Ivoire, which was selected in December 2014 for a threshold program, will now transition into the compact program after showing continued improvement on its scorecard and achieving greater political stability. Kosovo, which passed MCC's scorecard for the first time after making progress on democratic rights, is a new partner for MCC. Senegal successfully completed its first MCC compact in September and demonstrated improved scorecard performance over the life of the partnership. In both Senegal and Côte d'Ivoire, the board recommended that MCC explore potential investments that address regional obstacles to economic growth, in addition to domestic investments, while recognizing the need for statutory authority to optimize regional impact. The board also selected Togo and Sri Lanka to develop MCC threshold programs. Togo has shown a clear upward trajectory on overall scorecard performance over the past few years. Sri Lanka has embarked on a remarkable effort over the past year to reinvigorate its democratic institutions, improve governance, and restore protection of human rights. Nepal, Niger, and the Philippines were reselected by the board to continue developing their compacts. The board reselects all countries in compact development as part of the annual selection process. The board deferred a vote on the reselection of Tanzania and Lesotho for compact eligibility until relevant governance concerns in both countries have been addressed. Finally, the board reaffirmed its commitment to developing a compact with Mongolia and its support for a potential strategic partnership with India to advance economic growth and poverty reduction in South Asia. The United States, through the Millennium Challenge Corporation, is proud to work with its partners, new and old, in meeting the development challenges in the years ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.